Hello, and welcome to Learn on the Go, a podcast from Community Care Inform, where we discuss research, theories, and practice issues affecting social workers. I'm Joanna Silman, Senior Content Editor at Community Care Inform Children. This episode is about social workers' role in working with families and children who are affectees or at risk of female genital mutilation. In this conversation, as elsewhere, we're going to use the abbreviation FGM, although this is not to negate the reality of what we're talking about. We know that this can be a challenging area, and we have two guests who will bring their perspectives from both practice and research to try and help increase knowledge and confidence. They're not going to be explaining the different types of FGM. You'll find information on this, as well as the law and statutory guidance on CC Inform. There'll be a link in the show notes to that. So the focus is on supporting you to improve practice and reflect on some areas you may not have thought about before. So joining us are Maureen Maguni, a senior lecturer and doctoral researcher in social work at the University of West London. Maureen's practice and research background includes child protection, children's rights, immigration, homelessness, and mental health. For most of her career, she's worked with women and girls affected by gender-based violence, including forced marriage and honour-based violence, as well as female genital mutilation. Her PhD research focuses on the experiences of those affected by FGM and their engagement with social workers in the UK. And we have Zelia Camello. During one of her placements while studying social work at the University of West London, Zelia worked with a young person who had experienced FGM. She's going to talk to us a bit about that and what she learned. So shall we start by talking about some of the misconceptions and myths that there can be around FGM? I know in your research, Maureen, that you've come across misunderstandings, assumptions. What are some of the things that you think social workers would be surprised to hear or that you would most like to correct?
Thank you so much for the introduction, Joanna. So one of the biggest misconceptions or myths is the fact that FGM is linked to a particular religion. So most social workers or most people actually think that FGM is linked to Islam. However, FGM is actually not linked to any religion, and it's not a religious prerequisite. It predates Christianity, it predates most religions, and has actually been found to be more connected to the culture of those who practice it than the religion. There is also a misconception, at least by some communities, when they are sold the concept of female genital mutilation as similar to male circumcision, which has health benefits. What we do know about FGM is that it has absolutely no health benefits, and that is found in the definition of female genital mutilation. So the World Health Organization actually calls it a partial or total removal of the labia for no medical reasons. So that is the other misconception. Like I said, there are no health benefits, but also some people may argue that it is a cultural practice, so then it cannot be questioned. And you do indeed find workers in practice who are worried about questioning FGM because it's part of people's culture. So sometimes people can turn a blind eye, but it's important that, you know, we tackle it with the right tools. Social workers can actually have conversations around female genital mutilation, because not only is it considered gender violence, but it's also considered as violence against women and girls and child abuse in the UK. So those are some of the misconceptions I want to touch up for now.
Thank you very much. Celia, is there anything that you would add, maybe based on what you'd known about FGM before working with that young person versus kind of what you know now?
Well, before coming into social work, I mean, you all might be surprised, I was not aware of FGM. It was only when I came onto this course that I remembered one of our lecturers covering the human rights issues that mainly focused on women, that affected women in general. And when I learned that it was a global issue, I realized there wasn't much media coverage on it. And from this case, the young person I worked with, you know, I learned that FGM results in the purification of the woman and causes women to be more respected. They teach at a very young age how to present a perfect demeanor, how to be an ideal woman before getting married. So FGM is preferred by husbands. Otherwise, a girl would not be able to marry. So this is something I've really learned And there's a lot more which I'll also touch on later.
I really like the point that Zilia makes about, you know, how the communities perceive FGM. It is actually very true that within the communities who practice FGM, it's not seen as violence. So, you know, I can come in because I am not an FGM survivor or affectee. I can come in and say it's violence. You know, this is what the law says as well. But it's very important for social workers to understand that within the communities who practice it, it's not seen as such. It's actually seen as a rite of passage. And so it would be actually detrimental to assume that everyone that you're going to be talking to about FGM has a negative view of it. There's also the other thing where people think that FGM is an African problem or is something that happens outside of the UK. The fact is, there is no local authority in the UK that is free from FGM. You know, all the cities, the towns in the United Kingdom, FGM does exist, mainly because, you know, people move around, and because of migration, people settle wherever they will, and you find that FGM does exist, and it is a UK problem as well. And I say problem very carefully. We'll talk about language in due course.
Well, I guess, like, as you say, language seems quite important. The word problem, I know you mentioned whether this is seen as a rite of passage. I watched the webinar that you did with Siobhan McLean as part of her Student Connect series, and it sounded like that came out very strongly in your research, kind of practitioners' sensitivity or thinking about language when assessing families when there are concerns. Could you talk a little bit more about those areas?
So I've worked with FGM affectees for almost 14 years or so. And, you know, there are a lot of things that they report. But one of the things that's repeated by several of the women is the fact that the language used is very stigmatizing. So there are words that come up such as, oh, this is graphic, this is inhumane, this is senseless, this is primitive, barbaric, etc. So as much as one may have their view on FGM, it's really important to ensure that the language that we use when we're working with people does not actually continue, you know, stigmatize them. It doesn't cause further violence, because some of the women were talking about the interviews being quite repressive and oppressive because of how the practitioners were speaking to them, looking down upon them instead of talking to them. So it's really important that the language used is sensitive language, despite one's own values and beliefs. And it's really important, therefore, to use things like, you know, reflection, but also supervision, to talk about one's own values. And, you know, that self-awareness is really important when you're working in this field. I suppose concepts such as cultural sensitivity and anti-oppressive practice, as well as anti-discriminatory practice, they're a core of social work. So it's really important to ensure that we're employing this when we work with not just the affectees themselves, but obviously when we're working to protect the children, we want to ensure that we're not alienating the parents, but bringing them on board, so that if it is social change that we want to bring about, we have to ensure that sometimes it starts with education. Because remember, the women or the communities that you'll be talking to, they don't consider FGM necessarily as something that is bad in their communities. So it's about educating them about the law in the United Kingdom, about the negative health impacts, and so on and so forth. I actually have, for my PhD, a whole chapter on, the chapter's called Repressive Assessments, because the women reported that, you know, during these assessments, they felt like they were literally being oppressed. Some of the women were feeling like they were being quizzed. I was trying to actually find for you some of the, you know, the quotes. One of the women said, "It feels like a curse to come from the Gambia right now. I'm looked at very suspiciously by teachers and by social services, and this is very heavy for me." Another said, "It felt like a Spanish Inquisition. More appropriate questions could have been asked, but the social worker was too busy asking irrelevant questions for her curiosity." So for her own curiosity. So you see, lack of knowledge then means that the person is training on the during the assessment, but it's also about how you do it. It's really important to ask questions instead of making assumptions, but it's really important to ask the questions sensitively. One say that I felt that the social worker did not know what FGM was and did not actually have a good understanding of what my culture was. So I go back, you know, to always encouraging social workers to do their preparation. You know, when talking about the language, it's really important that, you know, we might call it FGM, it's called female genital mutilation, but remember the people who practice FGM, they don't see it as mutilation necessarily. So it's important to bring them into the conversation by asking them, what do you call this practice? And you can own that and say, we are going to call it this in our writing for the purpose of this, but please educate me and tell me what you call it and what you, how you would like me to address the practice. So it's, those are the important questions that are really good to ask because they show that you care, but also that, you know, you're being anti-oppressive. Those are just some of the findings that I have.
Thank you. Celia, was there anything you wanted to add, whether anything around language or being sensitive to how people might interpret you came into to your experience working with that young person?
Well, I remember before planning out on how I would be doing my key work session with the young person focusing on FGM, I remember thinking all the feelings and words that the young person could already be feeling, like the experience they went through and the aftermath and, you know, the sense of betrayal, anger and hurt by her family. While it is true that some individuals who have had female genital mutilation will report a sense of betrayal, I discovered that this young person did not at all. Instead, she felt it was an obligation, you know, to do it since her mother herself had it. But, you know, initially when I watched some videos about women who went through it and the way they were describing it, I had that picture sort of in my head and I was like, she might be going through it as well. So I need to be prepared. I was already prepared and I'd already assumed, which I shouldn't have done. But it's a learning curve. And I slowly accepted and didn't make a big deal about it. Instead, we started on, you know, focusing on her future and what else, you know, she could do. And like Maureen said, educating her on the laws and regulations, also on what safeguarding is.
Yeah, I can really see how that links to what you were saying, Maureen, about people may not see it as a bad thing that's happening to them. So, Celia, you've been touching on the experience that you had and the work you did. I think it will be really helpful for social workers listening to hear a bit more about the young person that you worked with and how you went about that work. Are you able to tell us a bit about how the child was referred to you, your sort of initial thoughts on meeting them, the work you did and the outcomes? Can you talk us through it?
Yeah, sure. So I worked with a 16-year-old female from Somalia. So we got the referral through the local council. She went through female genital mutilation at a very young age, and she was then married by the age of 14. So like my initial thoughts when I read this, I was surprised, a bit shocked, and I didn't know what to do. And I guess that's normal since it was something new to me. But the first instinct was like, I wanted to know more from her. So I did my research more on FGM, child marriage. And I thought of having my first key work session focusing on that with her. And so before carrying out the key work session, I printed out some emotion cards, which I translated in Somali already. The emotion cards were sort of to like understand what she felt before the experience, during the experience and after the experience. And I also used a series of close-ended questions because I didn't want to bombard her with, you know, a lot of questions, making her feel like, you know, the need to tell every single thing because I know it wouldn't be comfortable. And since she was 16 at that time, and the way she first came at the placement, she was anxious. She was anxious about her future. I didn't want to sort of, you know, start off with a lot of questions. You know, my close-ended questions included things like, did you have a choice? Did you feel like you had a voice in making a decision about whether you would like to have female genital mutilation? And then yes or no. She also completed a Wish Upon a Star activity, a feelings activity, the feelings wheel activity, how I feel about my future. I used the female genital mutilation direct work toolkit posted by a British Association of Social Work from their website. So it was quite helpful and amazing. There are lots of others which I can share the links of. So while I was doing this, she had the opportunity to talk. It was quite hard because we had to use the translator. And although I'd prepared things beforehand, she still had questions or bits where she didn't understand. So it was quite like a process. And then in the end, I raised awareness about how female genital mutilation is legal in the United Kingdom. And if she were to have her own children and she decides to reside in the United Kingdom, then she wouldn't be allowed to have female genital mutilation on her children. And so she told me that she went through quite a lot. She got married by the age of 14 and then her husband died 9 months later. And then after that, her father got kidnapped. And she said she had FGM because of her mother. And they sort of wanted to continue it from generation to generation and keep up with the family culture. And she also, you know, mentioned that we were taught before, sort of like preparation on how to be a woman. She used the word woman. Like I've said, how to present and, you know, a demeanor and how to be like this ideal woman to her husband, you know, doing all the household work. And that's something I picked up when she came at the placement because she had a very good personal hygiene routine and she knew how to, you know, keep herself clean and her surroundings clean. So when she told me that, I knew, okay, I understood. Yes, she was taught at a very young age on how to do things. You know, she would wake up early in the morning, start cooking, cleaning. And so I knew. In a way, she said it helped me because I was able to build independent skills, which are helpful at the moment. And like I've said, she didn't feel a sense of betrayal. She felt she was obliged to do it and she did feel scared. She did feel pain, but she didn't hold any grudge against her family or anything. She still loves her parents. So I guess as social workers, even though we feel that anger or, you know, it's like a form of violence, we need to really understand the context behind the young person having FGM and where they're coming from. And then when we sort of finished the key work session, I made sure she gets checked. So I booked an appointment with the nearest sexual health clinic. So it was a very long process because she did have some problems. She had some symptoms, which I thought would be something I need to prioritize. So I did that. And then also when she went for a health assessment, she was also reminded that it's illegal to have FGM in the UK when she disclosed that. And she actually accepted that. And she said, you know, yes. And she was also asked, would you do it on her children? And she said, I would not. And I'm happily ready to share my story. And I was quite happy that she was quite open about it. And also, I really appreciated the fact that she was able to trust me since the beginning, from her time at the placement until when she left, because she did say she felt comfortable. Because considering that there were more male support workers and I was the only female support worker there, she felt, you know, like she could have someone to talk to and come out to. Because when she started having symptoms, when she came and approached me, she couldn't go to the other male support worker. And also, I was grateful for my practice educator, my on-site supervisor. They helped me a lot and they sort of guided me through. And they told me not to just focus on her experience of FGM, because that's something she's already gone through. Now we're focusing on now, the present, what she would like to do from now on. What are her future goals or aspirations? Because she really wanted to study. And so from there on, she was quite comfortable. Her anxious levels dropped. She was fine.
Thank you, Celia. Yeah, it sounds like you did really thoughtful work with that young person, and you have given us a real sense of her as a young person in the round, not just someone that this happened to. Maureen, I see you nodding along to a lot of what Celia was saying. What are some things you'd like to comment on or add?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't nod anymore if I tried, because almost all the stuff that Celia said was just exactly what was coming out from the women that they wished someone had worked with them in that way. You know, what Celia was talking about is anti-oppressive practice. She worked with the young person as a whole person. That whole thing of not just focusing on the FGM, because although a person has had FGM, they're not their FGM. And a lot of women actually spoke about how they were considered as just the FGM. People just zoomed in on the FGM, forgot that they were human first, people who had had FGM, but they now became FGM and woman later or girl later. So, you know, that, I think that's really, really important. Also, one of the most important things I liked was the translation into Somali. You know, you went that extra mile to ensure that you were talking to the person and communicating in a way that they really understood and felt included. I'm sure that they would have felt special by you doing that, definitely. And I also, as a course leader for the practice educators, I'm very, very impressed to hear about your own experience, Celia, about how the practice educators supported you. Because I think one of the most important things is supervision and the education on placement. I think it's very important that we have this teaching for practice educators, for students, but also for social workers on an ongoing basis. So not just as a tick box exercise, but actually to go and find out, investigate the tools that can be used. Zelia touched on a lot of direct work that she used with the young person. And I think that's very important, because that's how you build the relationships. And it's important to see that it's not just taking direct work tools that are just there. It's trying out to make sure that they are fit for purpose. So you're talking to the person to find out what actually works with that person. And then reflecting, of course, there's a lot of reflection from Zelia's account, you know, what she thinks worked and what didn't work. In social work, we really believe in reflection and critical reflection, because that's how we improve our practice. So, you know, obviously for a subject as sensitive and as taboo as FGM, it's really important to have that reflection, but also self-care. You know, what you do after the difficult work that you've done, you also need to be thinking about how to actually care for yourself, either by debriefing, going to the gym, you know, doing something that really makes you happy, even listening to music. I had to do this after my interviews. I had to do this after a lot of my work and conversations with women when I heard some things that were quite harrowing. So that's just kind of giving back to yourself, recognizing that some of the things that you hear can actually cause a dent on you as well. So
yeah, thank you. Yes, really important points there. Was there anything you wanted to add based on that, Celia?
Yeah, so I actually wanted to add some of the human rights treaties that are relevant to FGM. I'll just read some which are non-exhaustive. So we have Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 2. Everyone is entitled to all rights and freedoms without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex. Article 3 states everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. Article 5, prohibition of torture or inhuman or degrading treatment. We have the Conventions on the Rights of Children. Article 24, right to the highest attainable standard of health. We have Article 19, prohibition of all forms of mental and physical violence and maltreatment. So these are just some of the treaties that are relevant to FGM.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess really reminding people of the human and children's rights aspect. to this. Yeah, I don't know if this links in some ways, Maureen, because I know that your research has also looked at some of the political, if we can call them that, issues surrounding FGM. And I guess I wanted to ask why you think it's important for social workers to be reflecting on the political aspects of it. How would they take that into their practice?
So I think FGM now, the more I delve into research, I realize how political a subject it is. So it's not just about the practice, but some of my findings, women were talking about, why is it just us who are being policed when there is female genital cosmetic surgery? How come the women who have that do not have their children being assessed? How come they're not policed? So, you know, there is a sense that there's some racism going on there. Women feel that because they come from a particular part of the world, that they are zoomed in on and treated as less than or othered. So I think that is part of the politics, but also within the social work assessments, there is an element or a feeling that, you know, some of the comments are quite racist. So going back to the language that's used, you know, if you're talking to someone and you're using a word like barbaric and primitive, that conjures up memories of things like slavery or colonialism. It talks to a place where people are considered as subhumans and not fully as belonging to a particular community. So that is just part of the politics of the FGM rhetoric. And that there is a lot of nuance around FGM as a topic, which is why it can be very difficult to tackle. I mean, FGM has been illegal since 1995, but, you know, up to date, there's only been one prosecution. So it shows just how complex a practice it is, but also how hidden it is. I'm going to be talking at a conference at the Hague in the coming month about the legislation around female genital mutilation. The mandatory duty to report FGM is something that all social workers need to be doing. You need to report as a social worker if you are aware, if a child, anyone under 18, tells you that they've had FGM, or if whilst you're carrying out your duty, you become aware of FGM. However, most social workers don't know, they don't understand this mandatory duty to report, but also don't understand FGM. So how will they do this if they don't understand? And within our teaching, there isn't so much teaching on FGM. Maybe once a year, you'll have a talk on FGM or do some training, but it's not really embedded in the practice. And of course, FGM is not the only harmful practice. And I put harmful as one of those words that need to be used carefully. But it's really important that it is something that is so delicate and can be easily missed, and also scary for practitioners to actually address because of the politics around it. I also want to add that it can be very dangerous to look at FGM as something that is just done by women, on women, because actually the communities that practice FGM are patriarchal predominantly. So we know that even though it is the woman who cuts, the gatekeepers are male. So it's really important that, you know, in addressing FGM or even in doing our assessments as social workers, we're actually bringing in the men into the conversation, because unless they take some sort of stand against FGM, FGM will continue. As long as women believe that they need to have FGM to get married, obviously the people who get FGM predominantly don't have a choice. But as long as the buy-in is for marriage, then it will continue. However, if men take a stand and say, no, we do not care to marry people who've had FGM, then we may start to see a change.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on what Maureen was saying. In the UK, we know there is this procedure called FGM safeguarding, which is a necessary preventive measure. However, the country has also had multiple allegations of targeting migrant communities under the pretense of wanting to protect children at risk of FGM. So people from the British Somali community report feeling targeted regarding the ethnicity only. Some of them said, I thought that safeguarding was when a child is in danger. But then for us, it was just because we were Somali. So some of the FGM safeguarding measures can be traumatic if they're deemed unwarranted by families, as they allow social workers and police to visit or inspect a household at any time without prior notice, and to sort of separately interrogate family members. And if procedure is not implemented carefully, it can create an added layer of discrimination for communities.
But not only that, it also can lead to rebellion by communities. You know, when the mandatory duty to report was introduced via the Serious Crimes Act in 2015, what I found in my practice was that the women that I used to work with at the time, they stopped coming to the support group because they now understood me as a person who was going to view them as criminals. So they really did not fully understand the law, or at least not appreciate it as it was intended for child protection, etc. So it's important to actually ensure that there is some sort of education and reiteration of the legislation as much as possible.
Yeah, you've both shown how complex it is in terms of what you're describing and how the law is framed, while being clear what the law is. Is there anything else that either of you would like to add that we haven't had chance to cover?
I think for me, some of the things that I want social workers to take away is when they work with FGM affectees and children at risk of FGM, to ensure that there is adequate preparation before going to a visit. Check out what the language is. Check out the cultural context or the context of where the people, the community come from. Also supervision, utilization of supervision. It's ever so important. I labor the point because of the sensitivity of FGM, but also you may hear some very difficult things, obviously depending on the relationship that you've built. And also just ensuring that, you know, one educates themselves on the law on an ongoing basis. Ensuring that you understand the law means that you can counter an argument which says that you are just coming to my house to tell me about my culture and you're being discriminatory. Your counter argument can be the fact that it is illegal to practice FGM in the United Kingdom. So as a social worker, I'm, you know, within my rights to tell you about the legislation, obviously always doing this respectfully. I want to re-emphasize being anti-oppressive in practice, you know, ensuring that one checks their own values and beliefs before going on this visit. Some of the things that you hear are going to be nothing like you've ever heard, say, within your own upbringing. If you are not from a community that practices FGM, you might feel shocked, but obviously you don't want to be doing this in front of someone. And you also want to ensure that even if you've read that FGM is the worst thing, you're not saying this to the person who's had FGM. You know, you need to actually be building relationships and not alienating people. Because one of the biggest things is when people go underground and they do cut the children, and then it brings about worse kind of cases. So, yeah, so it's about ensuring children, but also safeguarding everyone. And of course, we all know that safeguarding is the major business of social work. So we need to be very aware of how to do it.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for those really important points to end on and leave people with. So I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. I want to thank Maureen and Zelia for joining me and sharing. I'm sure you will both have given people a lot to reflect on and hopefully feel they've enhanced their knowledge to practice in an area that we know can feel daunting, but to be able to improve the experience of girls, women and their families. So you'll find links to all of the resources and legislation and research mentioned in the show notes. You can tune into other Learn on the Go episodes on a wide range of topics, including anti-racist social work, restorative practice and many others. Community Care Inform subscribers can access additional resources and written transcripts on the Inform websites. And if you're listening to this on a podcast app, you can subscribe to the series there. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and found it useful. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.